Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose wants to verify the citizenship of registered voters, and he's suing to do it. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our Friday News Review, we'll hear what LaRose wants from the Department of Homeland Security. We'll look at efforts in Ohio and across the country to remove voters from the rolls and restrict which ballots are counted. We'll also discuss the firing of a City of Cincinnati employee after an interaction with a demonstrator that involved spitting. We'll talk about how parents are responding to the Archdiocese of Cincinnati cutting ties with the Girl Scouts and a major restructuring of Cincinnati public schools that's been proposed. Joining me now to kick off our Friday News Review, our Washington Post reporter, Colby Itkowitz. Thanks for being here, Colby.
Thanks for having me.
Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Jesse Ballmer. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. And Signal Statewide state politics reporter Andrew Tobias. Welcome back to you too, Andrew.
Happy to be here.
Jesse, we're just a few days away from Election Day now. There's been a lot of focus in Ohio and around the country on who's voting. In Ohio, Secretary of State Frank LaRose, as I mentioned, has been focused on whether people who aren't citizens are voting. How often does that happen?
Well, it's a pretty rare situation. Just recently, Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost filed some indictments, some charges against six individuals for non-citizen voting. It turned out that one of those people from the Cleveland area was actually had already died 2 years ago. And so that's part of millions of people who have voted in recent elections in Ohio. So this is not a large number of people, but it is something that individuals who are concerned about it want to, you know, make sure it doesn't happen.
Andrew, Jesse just referenced this, what Attorney General Dave Yost has been doing, but that those people were part of a longer list that the Secretary of State had referred as potential cases to county prosecutors. Aside from what the Attorney General is doing, were there other people who were prosecuted as part of all that?
So you're referencing how since LaRose took office in 2019, he's referred around 600 people for forms of voter fraud. So typically after every election, and it kind of takes a while, so it kind of happens in arrears, but elections officials will cross-reference the records of people who have registered to vote and who have voted with other records that might indicate that they may have moved somewhere else, records that indicate whether they may or may not be U.S. citizens. And so, again, the number is 600 people that LaRose has referred over the last 5 years, which, you know, I expect that maybe 5.8 to 6 million people are going to vote in the election on Tuesday. So I don't have my calculator out, but there are some zeros in the decimals of what the fraction of a percent of the actual electorate that is. But to answer your question, there's only been around 10 to 15 criminal charges that have resulted from those referrals. And the recent prosecutions from Yost are an effort to, I guess, to catch up on some of those referrals. LaRose said that in some cases that prosecutors just haven't had the resources to look into these things. But again, we're talking about, you know, hundreds and really in all likelihood, dozens of people. You hear that there are explanations for why people may inadvertently register to vote if you're at a Bureau of Motor Vehicles getting a driver's license. There's, you know, I haven't done it myself for a while, so I don't remember if it's a form or if it's just a box that you check on a kiosk or something like that. But you're asked when you get a driver's license whether or not you want to register to vote. And so you hear that occasionally it happens inadvertently. But otherwise, you know, this is something that's checked regularly, and it's very rare that they find possible fraud, much less confirmed cases of it.
Jesse, with as rare as it seems to be, what's the message here? Is there a political message that's being sent with all this?
Yeah, I think there's always a spectrum, right, between election security, like you don't want people who are not allowed to vote in elections, and election access. So how easy do we make it for people to vote? And you're going to have people of different political stripes landing on different sides of that. There also just seems to be, and Cole can speak to this better, across the country, kind of like a preemptive look at possible voting issues in case the election goes one way or the other on the presidential level. And so are you kind of laying the groundwork for potential issues later.
Yeah. Colby, how does what's happening in Ohio compare to allegations of voting irregularities that are happening across the country?
Yeah, so we've seen across the country, we've already seen President Trump and many of his allies start pointing to isolated incidences as evidence of voter fraud. Non-citizen voting has been a big issue for the Republicans in the lead up to this election. They've kind of instructed some of their poll watchers to identify people at polling places who they think might not be legal citizens. And so that could really cause problems at polling places on election day if you do, in fact, have people challenging individual voters and whether or not they have a right to vote. But like I said, President Trump has been already saying that the election is going to be rigged. He's said that the only way that he can lose is if the other side cheats. Pennsylvania, which is a state that I cover very closely, is already in the crosshairs. It's, the most critical, potentially most critical battleground state out there, a must win really for President Trump. And there have been these incidences of mistakes made by election workers or things that might look a little untoward happening in isolated counties. But when you kind of look closer, you see that these are common mistakes that happen during elections. But President Trump has pointed to them as massive evidence of cheating.
Well, Colby, let's talk more about Pennsylvania because, as you mentioned, it's been at the center of several court challenges, and it is such an important swing state in this election. Tell us more about what's happening there in these court cases.
Yeah, sure. So, there's been a lot of preemptive court cases in the months ahead of this election, and a lot of them have been focused on mistakes made on your mail-in ballot. And so, for instance, in Pennsylvania, when you fill out your mail-in ballot, you stick it inside a secrecy envelope, and then you put that secrecy envelope inside a second envelope. And on the outside of that envelope, you have to sign and date it. Now, there's been a massive fight for years in Pennsylvania over whether or not that date on the outside envelope needs to be correct in order for your vote to count. So if someone mistakenly puts the wrong year, or they put their birthday, or they put election day instead of the day that they turned in their ballot, what judges have ruled, at least for now, is that if you indeed do make a mistake, and if you misdate or undate the outside ba envelope of your ballot, your vote will not count. And you will have to either fix it before election day or cast a provisional ballot, at the polls. And that's a really challenging thing for people that might be handicapped or elderly or homebound who are voting by mail because they can't go out, to a polling place. So we've seen a lot of efforts by Republicans, by the RNC and state Republican parties, both in Pennsylvania and across the country, looking for ways to have mail-in ballots, discarded or not counted for a variety of reasons, that date example just being one of them. Since voting has started, now we've seen, for example, in Bucks County, which is a massive bellwether suburb outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania doesn't do traditional early voting. They do mail-in ballot on demand, in-person early voting. So you go to an elections office and you can get your mail-in ballot on demand. And drop it off there. They cut off the line early in one elections office in Bucks County, which led to a lawsuit by the RNC, by the Trump campaign, rather. The Trump campaign won that, and now Bucks County has extended its early on-demand mail-in voting for another couple of days. But of course, President Trump took to Truth Social and alleged that there was this, voter suppression, voter fraud happening in Bucks County.
You mentioned the dates on these envelopes, and it seems like that would be especially tricky if you don't know you've put the wrong date on your envelope. I mean, is there even time for elections officials to alert people if the date is wrong so they can correct it and make their vote count?
That is such a great question because in Pennsylvania, you are not required to notice or, inform voters that they've made a mistake on their ballots. And so in some of the bigger counties like Philadelphia or Allegheny County, where Pittsburgh is, they put a list online of all the voters that need to do something called curing their ballots. Curing their ballots meaning fixing a mistake on their ballot, whether it was, forgetting the date or forgetting their secrecy envelope, whatever the case may be, there's a list online. And some independent groups will take the time to reach out to those voters and try and do what they can to help those voters get to an elections office to fix their to fix that mistake. But there's a lot of voters around the state where counties don't do that, and they will have no idea that their vote wasn't counted. Sometimes they never know unless they went back and looked retroactively. And so, yes, there are a lot of voters. And what election officials have told me, county election officials across the state, is that it is a form of voter suppression in that the date on the outside envelope has nothing to do with the legitimacy of your actual vote. And so the fact that your vote is getting thrown away on a technicality is a real injustice to those voters.
And which party tends to get the most votes by mail?
So traditionally, so vote by mail obviously had a huge surge in 2020 during the pandemic, and you really saw Democrats take advantage of that more than Republicans, because President Trump had kind of waged this war against mail-in ballots, had said that they were ripe for fraud and cheating, and that people were could throw them out or add more. And you know, there's no evidence that any of that is true, and it has been thoroughly and deeply investigated. So President Trump convinced his voters not to trust mail-in ballots. But that really was a detriment to Republicans in the 2022 midterms, where so many more Democrats voted by mail. And so Democrats could really focus their energies on Election Day on getting out the voters who were left, whereas Republicans had a much bigger turnout effort that they had to employ on Election Day. And so we've seen in the last year the Republican Party start pushing mail-in ballots, start pushing early voting. But what's so interesting about this is that, while they publicly push for more early voting, they push for voting by mail, they continue to file lawsuits trying to have mail-in ballots thrown away or discarded. And you still have the president at his rallies talking about how mail-in ballots can't be trusted. So there's a real contradiction in messaging, both legally and rhetorically, coming from the Republican Party.
Colby, there have also been challenges to overseas mail-in voting, even among members of the military. How big an impact could those overseas ballots have in this election?
I mean, quite a large one. I mean, what was really interesting about that, and that was also something that was largely focused in Pennsylvania. You saw six Republican congressmen file a lawsuit arguing that foreigners could apply for an absentee ballot overseas and pretend to be an American and influence our election. Again, no evidence of that ever happening. Even if there were isolated instances of that happening, not having, there would never be enough of it that it would actually influence the outcome. So what these Republicans asked for was that, all the overseas ballots that came, whether it was from Americans living abroad or from members of the military, should be segregated and not counted until they could each individually be proven. The citizenship of each individual voter could be proven. Members of the military were enraged by this, that they were, they're serving their country abroad and suddenly their votes are going to be segregated and they're somehow going to have to take an extra step to prove their citizenship in order to vote. Republicans, there's been a huge effort overseas. There's a group called Democrats Abroad that have been registering voters, Americans that live overseas, and trying to make sure that they're sending in their absentee ballots. And so it could be a large number. I don't know. We'll see when those numbers come through how much of an influence they'll have. But remember, this is an election that most people believe is going to be won on the margins. In this, the major swing states, the election is very, very close. We could see this come down to a couple thousand votes. And so maybe in some cases, overseas ballots will make a difference in some of these states.
Andrew, we've been hearing about Pennsylvania. We talked about what's happening in Ohio at the top of the show. What is the broader political strategy here in Ohio with all of this, or is there one?
I mean, we're talking about, so something that didn't come up earlier is that Frank LaRose notified around, or I think he asked election officials to cancel around 400 voter registrations in August. Again, it goes back to these possible non-citizens who are registered to vote. His office has been comparing BMV records, which somebody might not be a citizen when they get their driver's license, but then subsequently become naturalized. So that's one explanation, although obviously also another is that they're just not citizens and they're improperly voting. And so that's just another possible 400 people. I was describing the 600 people over 5 years who have been criminally referred for prosecution in the past. I just don't think these numbers are electorally significant, and so I just don't. I just don't think it's an election strategy. I think it's a political strategy. I mean, I think that nobody wants to say that they're easy on voter fraud, but particularly a Republican elections official in this broader national environment that we're talking about. I think it's about political messaging more than it's about electoral strategy, to answer your question.
What do you think, Jesse?
Yeah, I think Ohio, particularly in the presidential race, isn't expected to be tremendously competitive. And so you're not going to see those numbers of votes make as big of a difference as it would in states like Pennsylvania or even Michigan nearby. But to Andrew's point, Secretary of State Frank LaRose recently ran for U.S. Senate, certainly has political ambitions after leaving Secretary of State's office. And so it doesn't hurt to be on brand with the Republican messaging on this issue.
I do think it might be a little bit more politically intense if Ohio were the tipping point for control of the US Senate, which that was one possible scenario. But Republicans appear to be pretty safe to pick up Montana in addition to the West Virginia seat that they're basically guaranteed to take from Democrats. So the Senate majority doesn't appear to be on the line with the Sherrod Brown race. So I think that's one thing that might have intensified this just from an electoral stance. But the fact that that's not the case, again, for me, points back to just the political thing that I mentioned before.
Colby, how different is the political strategy in a swing state like Pennsylvania that is so important this election versus a place like Ohio?
Oh, I think incredibly. I mean, listen, Ohio still has a very important Senate race, as you were discussing. And so it's, there's a huge operation going on in Ohio. But in Pennsylvania, the get out the vote effort is, ground game is massive. You see the presidential candidates crisscrossing the state. Kamala Harris will have her last event of the election in Philadelphia on Monday night. The money spent in that state and in other swing states is astronomical. Outside groups and the campaigns and voters are inundated with mailers and commercials, and I'm sure many voters are eager for it to end. So it is, if you're a swing state voter, you feel a lot of love in the months leading up to election. But so I think that while Ohio is probably hearing a lot about their Senate race, probably less so about the Trump-Harris contest.
Well, I've been talking with Washington Post reporter Colby Itkowitz, Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Jesse Balmert, and Signal Statewide state politics reporter Andrew Tobias. Thank you all so much for your time today. It's been very helpful.
Thanks so much.
Up next, we'll hear about a confrontation with a protester that resulted in a Cincinnati city employee being fired. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A Cincinnati city employee was recently fired for an incident with a protester that involved spitting. Joining me now to talk about what happened is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy. Happy to be here as always.
Always great to have you here. So this city of Cincinnati employee was fired in connection with an incident that happened in August, as I understand it. What happened?
Yeah, so this was a city council takes kind of a summer recess, but comes back for one meeting in early August. And this was the day that city council had been in session for their summer session. A bunch of pro-Palestinian protesters had come to speak at public comment and then had organized a rally outside City Hall directly after the meeting. They were collecting school supplies for local schools and local children, and had a couple of speakers kind of focused on the needs of children in Gaza right now. While one of those speakers was speaking, she's actually a teacher. She's Palestinian and a teacher here in Cincinnati. While she was speaking, a man in plain clothes, sort of a jeans and a t-shirt, walked out of City Hall, spit on the ground 3 times directly in front of that speaker, and then walked through the rest of the demonstrators, made kind of a what's described as a dismissive gesture with his arms, both arms up in the air over his head. He then spoke to and kind of pointed in the face of a child who was there among the protesters and made a motion, again, described as if he were going to slap the child. There was no slapping. There was no physical contact between this man and any of the protesters. But that's the what's captured on camera in from a couple of different angles.
How did the city manager explain the decision to fire this person?
Yeah, well, it's important to mention that that wasn't the immediate recommendation. So there's a process that goes through for any kind of disciplinary action. So this went through a disciplinary hearing. The disciplinary hearing officer recommended 120-hour suspension. The man's immediate supervisor, the department head, recommended 80-hour suspension. The city manager decided, no, you know, she gets the final say, and she said that this man should be terminated, basically citing kind of a zero tolerance policy for hateful actions. Not directly cited in the city manager's decision. We got a very, very short statement from the city manager while reporting the story. But in the disciplinary hearing documents that were released to us, it includes this idea that, you know, this was a people exercising their First Amendment rights of protest and demonstration on City Hall property, and that this was an egregious action because it could discourage that kind of behavior, you know, discourage people from exercising their First Amendment rights, and that it could damage the relationship between the public and city employees. So those are things that went into this consideration as well.
You talked to several people who were at the demonstration when this happened. Talk to us about what they said about what happened and what they think about the decision to fire this man.
I spoke to the woman who was speaking when who was spit on the ground in front of. She decided not to go on the record, kind of fearing for potentially her safety and also just kind of the backlash that could come from this. You know, she said she was really shocked when it happened, was really surprised, wasn't expecting that, really confused at first. That's what some of the other folks who were there said to me as well. Really couldn't understand quite what was happening at first. And basically said, you know, it kind of made them think that there was all the more reason for them to be out and protesting and demonstrating. And, you know, saying like the teacher who spoke provided a statement and said, "We cannot let hate and ignorance prevail. We must continue to speak out even when it's difficult and others try to silence us, because that is how real change happens," was part of the statement she gave to us.
Hmm. Many of these protesters have been asking City Council for months to pass a resolution related to the war in Gaza. Where does that stand, and where does council stand on that?
Yeah, it's a complicated and somewhat difficult answer because council has passed a resolution related to this topic back in March. Now, there were protests coming for a few months before then, before council had spoken. So first, council did pass a resolution supporting Israel directly after the October 2023 Hamas attack. And so that was something that protesters were citing, as you spoke very quickly within a few days after that attack, but have not spoken, you know, at that point had not spoken at all about the conflict that was subsequent from that. So what the resolution that council passed in March was supporting a specific 6-week ceasefire that was under negotiation at the time. And this was a basically saying we support, rather than just sort of the general concept of a ceasefire, we support this specific proposition for a ceasefire that was under negotiation and was supported at the time by, you know, President Joe Biden and other world leaders. Some protesters and on sort of both sides of this issue praised that resolution and were really pleased with that and happy with the way that it looked at the end. Others were very disappointed with it. There was a separate permanent ceasefire resolution supported by Councilmember Mika Owens, who had proposed that. They supported that version instead and said it was cowardly and, you know, for council not to pass the more sort of definitive resolution. So, you know, I don't want to give the impression that council has said nothing on this issue, but certainly not the level that some protesters, including the ones who have continued to come to council after that was passed in March.
Hmm. Could this man who got fired appeal the decision? Is there any chance he could get his job back?
Yeah, absolutely. So he is a part of the union and is very likely to appeal the disciplinary decision. And at that point, it'll go through a sort of appeals process. And yes, he absolutely could get his job back. And, you know, the likelihood of that is really determined on lots of factors. But I think especially considering the fact that the city manager overrode what was the recommended disciplinary action, I think that there's at least a good chance that that could happen.
Have you heard from him? Has there been any response or reaction from him?
I have not. We did attempt to get in contact with him to give him the chance to respond before we published the story, but we were not able to reach him. You know, we attempted to reach him through the union, but the union declined to comment on the situation and also said they discourage their members from commenting to the media when there's ongoing action like this. And so they declined to pass along our message to him. So we just weren't able to get in touch.
Yeah. So our listeners will notice that we have not said this man's name. There's no name for this employee in your story.
That's right.
WVXU also decided not to post the video. You mentioned that there are videos from several angles of this incident. Those are not on our website. Talk about how that decision was made and why.
Yeah, so it was sort of two separate decisions, but definitely related. You know, we knew early on that the teacher that I spoke about did not want to be named on the record. And we were, after discussing with Marianne Zalesnik, our VP for news, and our other editors, had decided to honor that. It's a very rare decision for WVXU to, you know, honor anonymity because it needs to be kind of really specific circumstances. So knowing that, you know, that made our decision not to publish the video a little bit easier because we did not want to, you know, potentially identify this person who didn't want to be identified. The other decision in terms of the employee in question, we do know the name of the employee. I submitted a public records request to receive his personnel file and the disciplinary documents, and I did receive that, including his name. What I'll say about this person is that he is not a person who's a public figure. He's not someone that anyone would necessarily recognize unless you know him personally. And we have to make a decision as a news department what we cover and according to newsworthiness. And so when we're looking at, is something newsworthy, what is the journalistic value of publishing either, you know, a story in general or a particular detail of a story? And in this case, we felt that the story in general was very newsworthy, that it had journalistic value showing the city officials making a decision about their employees and sort of their tolerance level for, you know, what they determined to be a hateful incident. However, that there was no journalistic value in naming this particular person. You know, we did not get a chance to speak to him. He did not get a chance to defend his actions or give any kind of reason to us. And so, you know, we really felt this isn't someone who's going to be on the ballot. It's not someone that, you know, holds a lot of political power and influence. And so for those reasons, we felt there really was no journalistic value to publish his name.
And you mentioned you got a personnel file. Was there any indication that there was a history of behavior like this in the personnel file?
Great question. So officially, and this was referenced in the disciplinary documents, he had no history of disciplinary action. Now, what I did see in his personnel file, and I'm not sure if we ended up including this in the story or not, he had sort of an oral reprimand at one point in 2016 related to a customer service interaction. It seemed on the surface potentially similar in that it was described as him being sort of frustrated and having a bad day and kind of acting out of frustration and stress. But there was no indication that it was based on any sort of protected characteristics like race, gender, religion, et cetera. But again, there was very little information in that specific incident. And because it was only an oral reprimand, it wasn't kind of considered an official discipline.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in your reporting, you know, we've talked about how you weren't able to talk to this employee, but in the reporting, I guess in the disciplinary hearing investigation, he did have an explanation for his spitting. It's not the most appetizing thing to talk about during the lunch hour, but I think it's important to kind of say what he said happened with that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, although we did not get to speak to this employee, we do have a transcript of one of two meetings that we know happened between city officials and this employee, in which they gave him the opportunity to kind of explain. The spitting specifically, he described as allergies and having phlegm in his throat and needing to get rid of that phlegm. Now, I should note the disciplinary hearing officer basically didn't buy that, you know, that the explanation for recommending discipline in this case was that explanation didn't make sense to the disciplinary hearing officer. In terms of the other interactions, which obviously play a role in this as well, the pointing at the child, there was some verbal back and forth according to the disciplinary documents that I personally cannot hear on the videos that we have. It was very windy that day. But there was some back and forth, you know, about that. And his this employee's explanation for that was that he had had a very bad day, that, you know, things were not going his way. He was frustrated to come out of the building and see all of these people, and that he, you know, was just trying to get through them and he didn't want to confront anybody. You know, those are things that the disciplinary hearing officer also seemed to not really buy. You know, the counter to that was, you know, as soon as he had plenty of time to see the people out front as he walked down the steps, and he could have chosen to take in a different exit. And he also, you know, was easily able to navigate the small crowd without having to, you know, he wasn't blocked. There wasn't anybody blocking his path, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Well, I appreciate your coming on and talking to us about this. I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, the Cincinnati Archdiocese is cutting ties with the Girl Scouts, and Cincinnati Public Schools is considering a major restructuring. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We learned about some changes this week that could have big impacts on Cincinnati children and families. The Cincinnati Archdiocese is cutting ties with the Girl Scouts, and Cincinnati Public Schools is considering a major restructuring plan. Joining me now to talk about this are WVXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner and WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Tana and Zach, it's great to have you here.
Always good to be here.
Yes. Tana, explain what happened this week between the Cincinnati Archdiocese and the Girl Scouts.
So the short answer is the Archbishop, Dennis Schnur, issued a letter basically severing ties between the Archdiocese and Girl Scouts of Western Ohio, which is the local governing group for all the local Girl Scout troops.
Yeah. And how did he explain that decision?
So a little bit of the backstory here is that the Girl Scouts and the Catholic Church have kind of been working together for a long time. The church, the U.S. Council of Bishops, has objected to some of the Girl Scouts' positions since, like, I don't know, 2012 or so. And then there was a bunch of meetings, and locally they've been operating under a memorandum of understanding, and that expired in around 2021 on some things where the Catholic Church says their views don't align with the Girl Scouts' views. And so they'd been operating under this MOU. It expired. And then the church had brought up some newer concerns they have, which the Archbishop describes as an impoverished worldview regarding gender and sexuality, basically saying the Girl Scouts' views don't align with Catholic ideology, and therefore he sees no path forward for the two sides.
And are these troops made up of students from Catholic schools, or are these troops that meet at local churches?
It could be both, right? Mm-hmm. But essentially, you can no longer meet at a Catholic parish. A Girl Scout who is Catholic could still be a Girl Scout, I suppose, but she couldn't, you know, that's between her and her parish and her and her priest, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You talked to some parents who've been involved in Girl Scouts. What kind of reactions did you hear from them?
Yeah, I talked to several people, and generally they're just sad, and they're, you know, they told us they were disappointed. Now, there may be some other parents that I didn't speak with who like this decision, but the ones that I spoke with said, you know, basically text conversations had been popping off the minute the news broke, kind of late on Monday, I believe it was. Chat groups, I talked to some other folks that weren't in any of our stories, but said, yes, like, you know, private chat groups have just been going crazy with people talking about what does this mean? That's the big question. You know, a lot of people are sad or disappointed, they say, but the big question is, what does this mean for our troops and how are we going to move forward?
Yeah. What are some of the reasons these Girl Scout troops use Catholic parishes as their meeting places?
Well, you know, they're central locations usually. There are a lot of tie-ins with Girl Scouts to religion. There are certain religion-based badges that you can get and things like that. And it's just been that way for a long time. I remember when I was a Girl Scout 30 years ago, my church had a troop. It wasn't the one I was in. My mom led mine. But, you know, they're also usually affordable places to meet, right? So, and you can do larger events there. So, you know, your troop might do something, but you have a larger circuit or something they call it, and they, you know, can rent a Catholic parish for whatever day-long activity for a lot less than you might have to pay for, I don't know, an American Legion Hall or whatever else is on offer.
Sure. What are the troops based in local Catholic parishes being told to do? Are there specific kind of directions they're being given?
Yes. So they have three options. They can either disband, they can relocate, or they can convert to American Heritage Girls by the end of next year. And American Heritage Girls, some people may be familiar with, they're nationwide now. They're in all 50 states. They're similar concept to Girl Scouts, except for they're definitely a Christian-oriented focus. They're not specifically Catholic, but they do tend to align a bit more in Catholic churches. And they actually started here in Springdale in 1995. But like I said, they're nationwide.
Yeah.
So
what have been the reactions that you've heard from American Heritage Girls and from Girl Scouts of this Girl Scout organization that's so deeply affected by this?
Well, not surprisingly, right? American Heritage Girls are like, yes, please come on over. They sent out a press release right away. I talked to a leader who had been texted like the same day as the announcement saying, hey, do you want to convert? Which she actually found kind of offensive that they were jumping on it quite that quickly. And then Girl Scouts of Western Ohio say they're also disappointed in the decision. This is something they said, both sides said that they had been working on this for about 2 years. But they're going to support girls in all ways. And they say, you know, Catholic girls are still welcome in Scouts. And they just want everyone to be included.
Yeah. You mentioned that this has been in the works for a while. Is there kind of a deadline by which this separation has to happen?
Well, you have to, by the end of next year, you either have to disband, relocate, or switch.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Zach, let's move to you. Talk to us about the changes that would be part of this sweeping restructuring plan that Cincinnati Public Schools interim superintendent is talking about.
Yeah, so basically what this is phase two of the district's restructuring plan. And basically, if we look at what phase one was they took, say, students at Schroeder High School, they took the 7th and 8th graders there, move them into an elementary school building and turn that building into a middle school. They also put students at some other schools into different buildings. And basically what phase two does is more of that, but on a larger scale. So phase one was the start of this current school year. Phase two is going to affect 2025, next school year. So when we're looking at this phase, it's going to affect students at 30 CPS schools, nearly 30 CPS schools. So it is impacting a lot of students. And basically, it would mean a lot of shuffling, a lot of reorganization of the schools. So what we saw at Schroeder High School with moving those students out and creating a new middle school, they're going to do the same at Withrow High School. They're going to do the same at Clark Montessori, also Aiken and Western Hills as well. Now, nothing has happened yet. Nothing has been approved. This is a proposed plan. They're really putting it out there for board members to take a look at right now, for community members to take a look at. Right now, this plan is kind of being picked apart by the people that it's impacting, as well as the school board as well. So right now, there could be some changes to what this plan actually looks like once it's all said and done. And the plan might not be approved at all. There's certainly are plenty of people who are against what this plan would do, members of the school board as well. So this is just kind of the initial proposal right now, but certainly this could be a reality for the district moving forward.
Wow, you said nearly 30 schools. Any idea how many students that is? I mean, that sounds
it's
like thousands.
Yeah, it's thousands of students. I don't have an exact number on that, but it's a lot. It's a whole lot of shuffling, and we're talking about the west side, the east side, and the central part of town. So this is, like you said, a sweeping plan that is going to, you know, touch so many people within the district.
Yeah, and I would urge people to go to our website, wvxu.org, see your story. You have very detailed information about all the pieces of this puzzle that it's so much that I don't think we should get into all that detail
yeah.
in this conversation. But do you know if anything like this has ever happened in the district before? This does sound like a big, big change.
In this amount of time, I'm not really sure, right? Because this is, you know, a school districts change, Students move around, schools close, schools merge. It happens, fairly frequently, not just at CPS, but at other school districts around the country. But something like this, which has really gotten people's attention, is because this would be implemented for 2025. So all of this is going to happen within a year, all of that moving with nearly 30 schools. Now, phase one was introduced during the summer and was implemented over the course of like 2 months right before the start of the school year. This certainly gives them more time since, I don't know how many months, but almost a year to actually go through with this and make those moves. But certainly it's impacting a huge chunk of the district. And, you know, less than a year is, no matter how you slice it, it's not a ton of time for something like this.
Right. How much would all of this cost?
So in total, this is phase two, phase one, as well as some proposed future projects. So that includes some property sales, some renovations. It's going to be more than $200 million.
Wow.
With everything included. Now, the district leaders say that this would eventually be cost neutral. The reason why they're doing all of these changes is to make the school district more efficient, to save some money in transportation and some other areas. So, district administrators said, this is not going to cost the school money long term, but there is obviously some money up front that's got to be spent to do something like this. Now, we're kind of waiting for some more details on the cost of this, because certainly $200 million up front is a lot, and a guarantee that it's going to pay off and actually save the district money. Some people certainly have some questions about that.
Has there been any talk about where that money would come from?
So this would come from the budget still. And of course, there's levies that need to be passed in the coming years, a couple of them, I think, in the next six. So it's going to be a part of the district's budget. And of course, they're going to have to figure that out. So there are a lot of questions about this that have yet to be answered. They're going to meet again on Monday to discuss this further. I don't think anything's going to be voted on or approved at that time. I think there's a lot of engagement that is still going to happen here. A lot of parents, a lot of guardians and community members need to be talked to and consulted about this, because it's impacting a lot of people.
Yeah, it's big. What would this mean for school transportation and for magnet schools?
So a couple of magnet schools would lose their magnet designation for this. So looking at those schools, Woodford, Taft Elementary, College Hill Academy, those schools would lose their magnet status. And so basically what that means was they wouldn't be attracting students from all over the city. And because of that, because schools would be more neighborhood focused, students wouldn't have to travel all the way across the city to go to certain schools, or at least there would be less of that happening. So Shauna Murphy, the interim superintendent, said this would save them some money on transportation, because they wouldn't need as many buses, they wouldn't need to travel as far. Again, we're kind of looking for some clarity and some more specific details on how this would impact transportation. But she said there would be some savings there as well.
What kind of reception did this get from school board members?
Not positive from everybody. Now, of course, some members of the school board said, hey, we're just looking for some additional information on this. There is some recognition that a change like this would need to happen in order to utilize school buildings more efficiently and kind of balance the enrollment at a number of schools, because overcrowding is definitely an issue at a lot of schools in CPS, especially the high schools, especially schools like Western Hills and Aiken. They have more students than their building capacity really right now. So something like this will probably happen. What it will look like at the end, we'll see. But the school board's pretty divided on this. I know Ben Lindy, one of the school board members, said basically it doesn't seem like anything that is going to be proposed is going to be approved by him, at least right now. And some other school board members say we really need to see a lot more before we vote and approve something like this that is going to have such a big impact.
Has there been much response from the community at any board meetings yet, or discussion from parents about what this could mean for students?
Yeah, so quite a few parents came to the last meeting on Monday, a lot of them from Woodford specifically, who said, like, this is going to kind of upend kind of everything that we had set up. We like our school. We like our school community. We have our morning commutes all planned out, and we don't want to see that change. So a lot of people spoke out against this at the last meeting. I believe one person spoke in support of it, one community member. So we'll see what some other people say. I think there's going to be quite a few showing up next Monday to talk about this at 5:30. So right now, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of support from this from the community. There's still a lot of engagement to be done, but we'll see what they say on Monday.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate your reporting, and I should note that Cincinnati Public Schools is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. So, Tana, we've got just a little bit of time left. I want to talk to you about this dome.
Okay.
We talked about this on the show before. There's been a question raised about whether a dome could be placed on Paycor Stadium to have more kind of all-weather events there. What's the latest on the dome? How much would it cost to do that?
According to the estimates that the county got, it would cost between $903 million and $1.05 billion.
That's a lot of
money.
That's
a lot of money.
Yes. Wow. For a roof, basically.
Right.
So how did commissioners react to that information?
Well, so Denise Driehaus and Stephanie Sumrow-Dumas both said that's a no for them. That's way over there. Now, I want to clarify, this is not like they looked at it because it's, you know, super on the table, right?
Sure.
This
just
is
an idea.
An idea. They want to know. Commissioner Alicia Reese, Commission President Alicia Reese, asked for this presentation. And her big take seems to be that, you know, we're going into the Bengals lease negotiation discussions, and she doesn't want to, like, do whatever now and then come back in 20 years and have them say, well, we need a new stadium now because we needed a dome and you didn't put a dome, or we needed this and you didn't do this. So basically, what I can gather from listening to her speak at the meetings is she wants to know, like, what are every possibility that could be feasibly considered? What might it cost before we go into negotiations with the Bengals?
Sure, because those negotiations were certainly very detailed last time. I covered those more than 20 years ago. Yes. Okay, so Alicia Reese was like, hey, I want this information. But the other two commissioners were like, nah.
Well, Alicia Reese has not ruled it out. The other two commissioners said that's too rich for our blood. We're not interested in looking at that as part of our, you know, proposed things that we might consider, you know, negotiating with the Bengals. And
sure,
the Bengals have said they're not really interested in that either. It's just the county administrator suggested it's not feasible. Alicia Reese did say she doesn't want to hear it's not feasible. She doesn't want to be, you know, be told later, should have done it.
Yep. Woulda, shoulda, coulda.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for that dome update. We appreciate it. I've been talking with WBXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner and WBXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thank you both so much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
I hope you have a great weekend.
You too.
You've earned it. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director today is Ella Rowan. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening. Hope you all have a great weekend.